This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
So we come to lecture 10, Joseph, the Toledot of Jacob, but we've also called it Joseph's history. The theme of the section, God fulfills his promises in spite of the evil intentions of other people. Now with Abraham, you've got the promises that God makes and the struggle to see those work out in his life. With Jacob, it's character issues. The character of Jacob is the issue with him. With Joseph, it's adverse circumstances and people who want to do evil against him. That's what he faces. And we're going to see God providentially works in all these situations, but in this one, it'll be specifically stated that God is able to work out his purposes, even though people have meant evil. We also see how God is going to transform the sons of Jacob from a, if I can use this term, dysfunctional family, into a family that loves each other. So we're going to see a transformation of the sons of Jacob through these events as well. And one person will emerge as leader of the family. Now, the evil intentions. Chapter 37. Joseph's brothers hate him. And part of this hatred is due to Joseph's favored status. He is the favorite son. 37:3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age and he made him a tunic of many colors. Joseph is the favorite son. Jacob should have known by experience the trouble, that favoritism produces in a family. But Joseph's the favorite son. He treats him differently. His brothers hate him. This hatred also stems from the fact that Joseph reports the evil deeds of his brothers. 37:2, at the end of the verse, Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. He is this pestering, tattletale little brother who comes out to where the brothers are and runs home and tells dad all the bad things that they do. And this report might be true in light of some of the things we see them do later on. The extent of their hatred toward him is seen at the end of verse 4. They hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. They could not even carry on a peaceful conversation with Joseph. The dreams of Joseph fuel their hatred, and Joseph probably is not very mature here in telling his brothers his dreams. Because as you know, the story in the dreams stress the prominence of Joseph over his brothers. His brothers are bowing down to him. And this leads to the question that the brothers ask in chapter 37, verse 8, shall you indeed reign over us? Shall you have dominion over us? So they hated him even more. That's a key question. Will you indeed rule over us? And we'll see how it works out. The fruit of their hatred is seen in their plan to get rid of Joseph. 37:18, they conspire against him to kill him. Now, Reuben, firstborn son, intercedes on behalf of Joseph. He tries to protect Joseph, but he seems to have an ulterior motive. 37:22, Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him. Comment that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. Reuben needs to get back into the good graces of his dad. And so he is interceding here for Joseph, trying to save Joseph. But as we will see throughout this account, Reuben, although he's the firstborn son, his leadership always falls short. Now, while Reuben is gone, Judah takes the lead. And they sell Joseph into slavery. And they come up with a plan to deceive their father. Interesting, Jacob deceived his father with goat skins. And now he is deceived with goat's blood and his own son's cloak. And you know the story, they sell Joseph and they take his cloak and they dip it in blood and they bring it to Jacob and say, "This is what we found." Now Reuben's response is cowardly. He returned to his brothers, 37:30, and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? Now what am I going to do now? You've taken away my opportunity to get back into the good graces of a father." And so he's really only concerned about himself. He does not confront his brothers with what they've done. He does not go after to try to get Joseph back. A cowardly response. Yet there are hints of well-being at the end of chapter 37. Joseph is with Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Potiphar is someone who has a high place of responsibility. Now, we're going to skip 38 for a second. We're going to come back to it. Let's jump to chapter 39 and very quickly review the events of chapter 39. Then we'll come back to chapter 38 and sort of try to set chapter 38 in its context. You know the story in chapter 39. False accusations lead to prison. When Joseph gets to Egypt, he's blessed by God. He's made he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. He found favor in his sight, verse 4. He made him an overseer of his house, verse 4. And all that he had, he put under his authority. Joseph must have had tremendous administrative abilities, because everywhere he goes, he gets put in charge of stuff. And here he's put in charge of Potiphar's whole household. Well, Joseph is a young man who's handsome in appearance, it says, at the end of verse 6, handsome in form and appearance. And Potiphar's wife casts longing eyes on Joseph, verse 7 says, and she says, "Come, lie with me." Joseph refuses. The master has committed everything into my hands. Verse 9, there's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back any threat. Anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So not only would it be a sin against Potiphar, it would be a sin against God. Joseph has the right perspective in this situation. Well, she persists, and Joseph flees one day. She grabs the coat and falsely accuses him, and that's how he ends up in prison. So you have his brothers who conspire against him, and now you have Potiphar's wife who sort of conspires against him, and he lands in prison. Yes, sir.
The one thing I did have is how they were using
I don't know. I'd have to think about the parallels. You're talking about just a general parallel of choosing for what's good.
Well, just the idea of him selling Potiphar's wife, Potiphar's union position, to have
to. So that would be the abundant provision, except for this one thing. Yeah, you might be able to legitimately draw some parallels between that. Yeah. Now we come back to chapter 38, which many believe is misplaced. It has no connection to the rest of the context. But I think once we understand chapter 38, we will begin to see some connections with the context. There's sort of a literary angle here. If you've ever been reading a novel, and the chapter ends with the main character in sort of a precarious situation, and you can't wait to begin the next chapter, and then the next chapter picks up a different thread of the story. Oh, no, I got to wait before I find out what happens. Well, there might be some of that here, because at the end of chapter 37, you know, Joseph is in Egypt, or is in the hands of Potiphar, and we have to wait till chapter 39 to find out what happens. There may be some of that here. But in chapter 38, you have the story of Judah and Tamar. And this is very important in light of the issues of leadership for the family. 38:1 says that Judah departed from his brothers. It doesn't say why he left. But it's interesting, it's after this conspiracy against Joseph. You wonder if that has brought strife among the brothers. Perhaps guilt. We don't know for sure. But he leaves. And he acts foolishly. And he acts unrighteously. In chapter 38. Judah, in chapter 38, marries a Canaanite woman. Her name isn't even given. Daughter of Shua. But she is a Canaanite. He has three sons. No relationship to the Ur frog. Nobody knows what that means, right? Yeah, there you go. You know those commercials of the Ur frog? No relation to the Ur frog. Well, those are some good commercials. Anyway, Onan is the second son, and then Shelah is the third son. Ur marries Tamar, a Canaanite woman. What happens to her? Now, maybe you haven't read the story yet, but her, verse 7, Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. So he's gone. Now, in the culture of that day, and we'll talk about this later, when we talk about the law, in the culture of that day, the idea was that the next son, so you have Ur and Tamar married, but no children, all right? In the culture of that day, Onan now should marry Tamar. And through this union, hopefully there will be a son produced, and that son would take the name of the original brother who's now died, and this son would inherit that property. Now, we'll talk about the Levirate marriage is what we'll eventually talk about when we get over to the law section. Onan does not want to do this. If he raises up a son, he gets less inheritance. And so you can read the text, but he sort of has the pleasure of the relationship, but not the consummation of the relationship, if you know what I'm talking about. The text will tell you that. And so there's no son produced. And God gets upset with Onan and kills him. Shalit is left. And now Judah might be thinking, boy, that Tamar, she's a dangerous woman. And he promises Shelah to Tamar, but it never happens. Time passes. Time passes. Shelah is never given to Tamar. Judah's wife dies. And at harvest time, or at sheep shearing time, a time of celebration, Tamar poses as a prostitute. Judah takes the bait. Tamar requires that he leave behind personal belongings so that he can be identified later. And he says, I'll send for those later. I'll send you sheep, whatever. Judah and Tamar have a relationship. Judah is not aware of it, and Tamar becomes pregnant. And Judah finds out about it and calls for her to be brought out to be put to death. And that's when she brings out these personal things that identify Judah as the father of the children. Tamar takes matters into her own hands. And it's interesting, some later Hittite and Middle Assyrian laws allow the father-in-law to raise up a child through the widow, but the Old Testament never goes that far. Now, Tamar is a Canaanite, so, and the Old Testament law is also later. That's the story. What are the connections? Deception. The theme of deception runs through these chapters. Joseph's brothers deceive Jacob. Judah is deceived by Tamar. And Potiphar's wife deceives her husband about Joseph. This also is going to create contrast between the faithfulness of Joseph and the unfaithfulness, unrighteousness of Judah. Joseph behaves honorably. Judah does not. We also begin to see the development of the character of Judah. Reuben is the firstborn, but Reuben's leadership is always going to fall short. We see Judah here in a very bad light. Except he does, and some think this may be a turning point, he does recognize in verse 26, Judah acknowledged those personal items and said, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. Judah is selfish, visionless, callous toward his father, not caring about the covenant family. All of that you could say about Judah in verses, in chapters 37 and the beginning of 38. And yet, he is the one who's going to emerge as leader of the family. So we are going to see a development related to the character of Judah. And I think that's part of the reason why this story is placed here. Tamar is the heroine. A Canaanite. And that shocked you. She rejects her Canaanite father's house. She could have walked away. She could have married any Canaanite she wanted to. She remained faithful to Judah. And through her union with Judah, twins are born, as you see at the end of the chapter. And these sons, Perez is the younger son, Zerah is the oldest son. It's Perez, the younger son, that becomes prominent and that is a part of the messianic line. Ruth 4:18 in that genealogy, Matthew 1:3. And is there significance to the fact that it's the younger son that is prominent? What did they say to Joseph? He's not the youngest, but what did they say to Joseph? Will you indeed rule over us? You have this theme all throughout the patriarchal history. God doesn't work according to cultural expectations. The younger son many times is the one. And you sort of have that here as well. And perhaps it's teaching that God's design for Joseph's prominence cannot be thwarted. So I do think chapter 38 is vitally connected to the context, especially related to Judah and the development of the character of Judah that we are going to see as this story unfolds. Yes, sir. I said earlier, you probably just went right by it, that the wife of Judah is never named. She's just a Canaanite woman. Yeah. So she's the daughter of Shua. And I think that's somewhat significant. He marries a Canaanite woman. That's not good in God's eyes. And so this woman is not named as a part of the account. Now, we come back to pick up the story with Joseph. We left him in prison. Lo and behold, God blesses him in prison. You know, all the adversity that Joseph experiences, God continues to bless him and pour out his blessing. He is put in a position in prison of oversight. And to make a longer story short, we won't go through all of the dreams that he interprets in prison, but one of those dreams that he interprets, is it the cupbearer or the baker? Oh, he's the cupbearer. He interprets, yeah, okay, good, thumbs up with the cupbearer. And so that when Pharaoh has a dream, some dreams in chapter 41, the cupbearer remembers Joseph. And Joseph is brought up to interpret the dreams of Pharaoh, which he does. He tells Pharaoh what his dreams mean. Let me see where that interpretation is. Verse 26, 41, 26, the seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years, and dreams are one. The seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. And Joseph basically says there's going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine, and you need to put somebody in charge of preparing for those 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, you are the guy. And so Joseph is elevated to a very high position in a public act of installation. He is placed in charge of the palace, 41:40. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. He sets him over all of the land of Egypt. People are to submit to Joseph. Only Pharaoh is greater. Joseph's authority is displayed in verse 42. Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, and put a gold chain around his neck. He puts him in a chariot, the second chariot, and people cry out and bow the knee. Tremendous position. of authority. How old is Joseph? I think that's correct. He is 30 years old. 41, 46, he's 30 years old. He's also given a new Egyptian name. 41, 45, the name Zaphnath-Paneah, which means God speaks and lives. He's also given a wife. Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Probably elevated to nobility through marriage. 30 years old. He has all this power. A new Egyptian name, a new Egyptian wife. Daughter of a priest in the Egyptian religion. What's the question? Will he be faithful to God? Will he be faithful to God? That question has been asked throughout history. In fact, there is a work that comes out of the what we call the intertestamental period, Second Temple Judaism period, first century B.C. or so, a work called Joseph and Asenath. And they struggle with this. And here's one of the ways they resolve the question or the issue. Listen to their description of this Egyptian woman. She was very tall and handsome and beautiful to look at beyond all virgins on the earth. This girl had nothing similar to the virgins of the Egyptians. She was in every respect similar to the daughters of the Hebrews. She was as tall as Sarah, and handsome as Rebecca, and beautiful as Rachel. And the name of that virgin was Asenath. And the fame of her beauty spread all over the land and to the ends of the inhabited world. And everybody was asking for her hand in marriage. It goes on to describe this turmoil that Joseph goes through. Until finally Asenath makes a commitment to Yahweh. And then they marry. That's how they tried to solve the problem. You know, here you got a 30-year-old young man who's given a new Egyptian name and a new Egyptian wife, daughter of an Egyptian priest. And so, you know, their solution is to say she became a believer in Yahweh first. Well, the text doesn't say that, but we do have evidence of Joseph's faithfulness. And we see it in the names that he gives to his children. They are Hebrew names, not Egyptian names. Manasseh. And these are described in verses 50 to 52. Manasseh, one who causes to forget. And perhaps it's a statement that Joseph has closed the door on the harsh treatment he received in the past, and that it no longer has a hold on him. He's forgotten all of that. Manasseh. Ephraim. Fruitfulness. God can turn affliction and hardship into a blessing. So I think the fact that he gives his children Hebrew names makes a strong statement. He shows where his true allegiance lies. In fact, at the end of the book of Genesis, he tells his brothers to carry his bones out of Egypt. Now, you have to remember, Joseph, in the position that he was in, would have received a burial on a level that they buried the pharaohs. But this is not my true home. When you leave for the promised land, take my bones with you. That's where his true allegiance lies. And Hebrews 11:22 says he He said this by faith. By faith. So, I think there's evidence that he does remain faithful to God, even though he finds himself in this particular position. Now, we come to the testing of Joseph's brothers, which occurs in chapters 42 through 45. And the famine has now hit. And 42:1, when Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another? Why don't you guys do something?" this is Dad encouraging the sons, let's do something about this situation. This whole thing is set up in verses 6 and 7. As these brothers of Joseph come to Egypt, Joseph is governor over the land. It says in verse 6, Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. What does that remind you of? The dreams that he had. Joseph saw his brothers, recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And at some point it says he spoke to them through an interpreter. So he does not give away who he is. And what he's going to do is he's going to put them in a position where they're going to have to react to certain situations, and he's going to find out if the character of his brothers has changed since the days they sold him into Egypt. And so he treats them harshly here. He accuses them in verse 14 of being spies. And he begins to ask about the family. He puts them in prison for 3 days. And then he brings them out and says, if you are honest men, bring, he's already found out I'm a younger brother, bring your youngest brother to me. Don't come back here without your youngest brother. Then I will know that you are honest men. Now, you have to picture this scene. Joseph is standing there, and now they begin to talk to each other, and they don't think Joseph, they don't think this governor can understand them. Joseph hears this. Verse 21, they said to one another, we are guilty concerning our brother. Talking about Joseph, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Of course, Reuben chimes in, didn't I not speak to you? Don't sin against the boy, and you would not listen. His blood is now required of us. They did not know that Joseph understood them, because he spoke to them through an interpreter. He turned away from them and wept. Great scene. And he sends them away. But he keeps behind Simeon. He keeps Simeon in Egypt, and he sends them back to their land. And lo and behold, as they go back to the land, they open up their sacks and they find their money. The money they had brought to pay for grain, they find that money in their sacks. And that's part of the test. Will they abandon Simeon? Or will they go back and perhaps even put their own lives in danger by being accused of being thieves? They've already been accused of being spies, and they're not really spies. But now this money that they paid is right back in their sacks. How will they respond? Let's see. Well, they go back. They tell Jacob. And they tell Jacob that we can't go back and get food without Benjamin. And Jacob says, there's no way I'm sending Benjamin back. I've already lost one son who's dear to me. Well, this is where Reuben steps forward as the oldest son, 42:37. He says to his father, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. What good would that do? Kill my two sons. That would only jeopardize the family. Judah then steps forward and takes responsibility. And he says to his father in 43 verses 8 and 9, send the lad with me. We will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. For my hand you shall require, for from my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Judah puts himself on the line in terms of the safety of Benjamin. He risks himself for the sake of his brother. And that convinces Jacob to send them back with Benjamin. They need food. And so they go back to Egypt. 43:23, there's a reunion with Simeon. And there's sort of an explanation about the money in their sacks. Well, God must have blessed you with treasure. They are invited to Joseph's house. And they are brought into the table. And they are sat down at the table. And they are sat according to their birth order. 43:33, they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at astonishment. In astonishment at each other. They couldn't believe it. As they looked around the table. And then Benjamin is given much more food than the other brothers. How will they respond? Will they be jealous of Benjamin? I think this is a test that Joseph is placing before them. Benjamin serving, verse 34, was five times as much as any of theirs, so they drank and were merry with him. It was not a problem. They did not react in jealousy. Now comes the final test. Joseph, they get food, they are sent back, but they put Joseph's cup into Benjamin's sack. This is the test. Will they abandon Benjamin like they abandoned Joseph? And of course, they leave from Egypt. And they are overtaken by Egyptians. And basically, then each man must open his sack. They began with the oldest. And they come down to Benjamin's sack, 44:12. And it was in Benjamin's sack that the cup was found. They tore their clothes. And they loaded their donkeys. And they go back to the city. And they're confronted by Joseph in verse 15. What deed is this you've done? Did you not know that I would have found out about this? And there's a mention of divination here that we need to come back to if we can. But let's move on here. Judah says, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found. And so he acknowledges here that they're reaping their prior deeds against Joseph. And Judah enters into this plea, this intercession for Benjamin. And he begins to talk about what this would do to their father. If we do not bring back Benjamin, this will virtually destroy our father. it's this that brings Joseph to the point of revealing himself to his brothers. 45:1, he could not restrain himself. He tells everyone to go out. No one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? His brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. Can you imagine their jaws? The shock. This is Joseph. That's another great scene. In fact, there's a recent movie that's been put out that I have not seen, but I heard they're supposed to be pretty accurate. I'd love to see this scene. You see, Judah and the brothers show a change of character. They're not the same group of brothers. And part of that process of change has come through all of these events, where they are brought to the place where they recognize the iniquity of what they did to Joseph. And Joseph is right there to hear them confess that. And then to hear about his father. And to acknowledge to them who he is. And of course, they're a little afraid now, aren't they? But Joseph assures them that he has no thoughts of taking revenge. And it says in 45:5, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God set me before you to preserve life. And there's another statement at the end. When Jacob dies, the brothers are concerned again about Joseph. And this is just a great statement. Chapter 50, verse 20. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about it, in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. The sovereignty of God working even when people have these evil intentions. Well, to bring this sort of to a close, Jacob comes to Egypt. Here's Joseph's alive. And in the strength of that, he comes to Egypt. And he is met by God on his way to Egypt. And God assures him that the family is going to Egypt with his blessings. And I think part of the reason that God brings his people to Egypt is to separate them from the Canaanites. Because there's animosity. Well, animosity might be, not be the right word. There's very little chance that the Egyptians and these Jewish people will interact with each other. The practices are abominable to the Egyptians. That may have to do with sacrifice of animals, and the Egyptians look at in some degree as gods. It may have to do with shepherding things, but you'll come across several statements related to this effect. And I think part of the reason is God's bringing his people into Egypt, separating them from the Canaanites. Time will go by. The iniquity of the Canaanites will increase, and the time will come then when God will bring his people back to the land of Egypt. I'm sorry, Promised Land. Now, let me push on for just a little bit longer. There are some things that happened in 48 and 49 that are significant that I want to touch on. And that basically then brings us to the end of this lecture. In chapter 48, Joseph brings his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, to see Jacob, their grandfather. Jacob repeats the promises of God and the goodness of God in verses 3 and 4, and then he makes a surprising move. He adopts Manasseh and Ephraim as co-inheritors with the other sons of Jacob, so that Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, are now on the same level as the other sons. And so when you think of the 12 tribes, 12 sons, the 12 tribes, Levi is not included. We'll talk about why that is. There's not a tribe of Joseph because of Manasseh and Ephraim. So you take out Levi, you take out Joseph, and you add in Manasseh, you add in Ephraim, and you've got the 12 tribes. And so that is a surprising move here. Manasseh and Ephraim are now treated as sons. Then there's another surprising move. When Jacob blesses Manasseh and Ephraim, he switches hands. The right hand should go on the oldest, the left hand should go on the youngest. But like we've seen so many times in Scripture, he switches hands. He puts the right hand on Ephraim, the youngest, and his left hand on Manasseh. Ephraim will be more prominent than Manasseh. In fact, the tribe of Ephraim becomes the most powerful tribe of the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom many times is even identified by the name of this tribe. Then Israel blesses the 12 tribes in chapter 49. We're not going to go through all of these. I just want to comment on a couple of them. Jacob is cast into the role of a prophet who beholds the future. And he looks at the condition of his sons, and he makes a prophecy about the tribes, about the descendants of those sons. Reuben is the firstborn. But Reuben fails. Why? Verse 4, unstable as water, you shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed. Remember that incident we talked about earlier? Reuben, as a tribe, fades into insignificance. Then Simeon and Levi, verses 5 through 7 of chapter 49. They are cursed because of the Dinah episode. Remember the Dinah episode? They were the leaders of that deception and treachery. And so you read in verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. The tribe of Simeon is basically integrated into the tribe of Judah. Simeon is south of the tribe of Judah. And you can even, Joshua 19:1 sort of makes the tribe of Simeon almost as a part of the tribe of Judah. And then Levi is scattered. Levi does not receive a portion of land when the land is divided. Now, this curse of being scattered is actually going to turn out into a blessing. And we will see how that happens. But that remains for a little bit later. We come to Judah. Judah receives praise. Judah is described as being a lion, which fits the kingly terminology. Here in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Judah will be triumphant, and there will be kingly authority that will rest with Judah until Shiloh, which is the way my translation translates it. This is 49:10, until Shiloh comes. Now, Shiloh could be taken as the name of somebody or as a place, but neither kingly authority nor things related to Judah have much connection with a person or a place named Shiloh. This word is a combination of three Hebrew words, or three Hebrew particles, which I may have listed in your in your notes. That's a transliteration of the three Hebrew particles, which basically can be translated roughly, which to him. And this is the translation of the NIV. The scepter will not depart from Judah until he comes to whom it belongs. And I think that's very possible. The only problem with that is it doesn't explain, without getting into the detail, it doesn't explain this. For this translation to be accurate, it would have to have this rather than this. Yet there is an Ezekiel passage that uses a similar phrase. So, you know, the NIV translation is possible. The other way to take this and to make sense of this right here, there is a Hebrew word that means tribute. And I believe the ESV may translate it this way, until tribute is brought to him, and his is the obedience of the peoples. So, all three of these are messianic. The debate here is not whether one is messianic and one is not messianic. All three of these would be a messianic statement. And basically, the meaning is that kingly authority will remain in the tribe of Judah until that one comes to who it belongs, or until tribute is brought to that one and the obedience of the peoples. Whether you translate it NIV or ESV, the meaning is basically the same. There will arise someone from the tribe of Judah who will have kingly authority. That's what this passage is talking about. And then if you go on to read verses 11 and 12, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. What do you bind your donkey to normally? Do you bind him to a vine? No, because vines take 3-4 years to grow and cultivate till finally you get grapes. Vines are very precious. You don't bind a donkey to a vine because the donkey will tear the vine up. Vines are going to be so plentiful. You're going to bind your donkey to a vine. Wine is going to be so abundant. That's going to be washing your clothes in wine. You don't wash your clothes in wine, but this is a picture of abundance. His eyes are darker than wine. And his teeth whiter than milk. I think this is a picture of health. When this person comes, these tremendous blessings are going to be a part of that person's coming. Now, you have to take this and put it into a now, not yet situation so that ultimately these blessings, like is stated in the Amos, the hills will drip with wine. You know, ultimately, those blessings will be fulfilled in the new heavens and new earth. But when this one comes, God will pour out. These blessings will be a part of it. One more thing, and we're done with this lecture. And I'm not going to go through the rest of the tribes, but the ones up to Judah, I think, are very significant, and so that's why I've spent some time on them. And this is, I would say, a messianic text. Now, we're at the end of Genesis. The Israelites are living in peace in the land of Goshen. God's promises are being fulfilled. I will make your name great. Joseph, his position in Egypt, I will make you a blessing. Joseph, certainly a blessing in terms of providing food during those famine years. I will make you into a great nation. That's in process of being fulfilled. Exodus will open up with the superabundance of the growth of the children of Israel. Nations will come forth from you. Well, perhaps we've seen some of that with the Ishmaelites and the Edomites, but that's also in process. And I will give you this land. That's in process. They're in Egypt, and as we will see, they will begin to make their way toward the promised land as Joseph himself looks forward to that day.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.